Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. This is probably one of the biggest audiences I've seen at an insight session. We've got however many in the room, and probably the same number again on the webinar. So great turnout. This session, introductory session on life insurance regulatory capital, is an initiative of the Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee to, one, cater to younger actuaries, but also to try and take more technical topics and make them accessible to people who aren't necessarily experts in particular technical fields. So capital seemed like a good place to start, and thank you very much to Ross for agreeing to present today. Just a little bit of background on Ross. He's the technical actuary for capital management at CommInsure. He's been working at CommInsure and predecessor firms his whole career. He's particularly well placed to give the presentation today. He's been in the capital management role throughout the development and implementation of the LAGIC standards. And so he's really is one of what is still a relatively small and elite group of people who can call themselves experts in the current capital standards. But hopefully, thanks to sessions like today, that group will be growing. In his current role, he's responsible for maintaining and improving the tools used in capital management at CommInsure. And so he has a good practical knowledge of the standards as well as a theoretical knowledge. He's a qualified actuary with over 25 years' experience in life insurance. He's previously worked in financial reporting with a particular focus on participating business. And I think this was mentioned in the flyer. He spent his long service leave working in Tonga, teaching English to school kids. Slightly unusual experience there. So on that note, I'll hand over to Ross.
Thank you. Thank you, Anton. So today we'll be looking at what are the requirements of the LAGIC standards for life insurance, and what do they look like in practice, at least from CommInsure's perspective, I guess. Why would we want to do this? I would say the most important reason is so that you, if you're in life insurance, you understand risk. So these standards, along with the rest of your ICAP, if you implement it well, if you do it well, then it will give you remarkable insight into risk. It will give you insight into what are the risks of each of the particular products that you're selling, what are the risks of the assets that you are investing in, what are the combinations of risks between those, and more. So, of all things, understanding this will help you understand the risks. If you looked recently through the annual reports of life insurers, you'd have seen that there has been quite a lot of change in their capital structures of late, so there's been a lot of capital raisings, some reinsurance deals, various things. So if you're involved in that, you clearly want to be able to say to the person you're asking for this capital why you need it. So you need to understand your capital position to be able to do that. If you're working in pricing or on the asset side in life insurance, again, capital will have a lot to say. So it's valuable to understand what is driving capital requirements. So today, I have a few slides really as background, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of the standards and implementing them. So firstly, the scope of what I'm looking at. I'm looking particularly at calculating regulatory capital based on the Prudential Standards 110 through to 18. In the Prudential Standard 110, it says it's aiming for a 99.5% probability of sufficiency over 12 months. In developing the standards, APRA seemed to be quite clear in saying they weren't thinking of a particular scenario. This was not a wind-up or an ongoing scenario. It would have elements of both of those. They were not aiming to target either of those in particular, say, as in the way the previous capital standards did. So having said that, that means we're not particularly considering other capital reserves that you might be holding, like target surplus or working capital. And whilst it's a valuable insight into risk, the regulatory capital gives you a particular perspective on risk. It's not the only perspective by any stretch. And you probably have to say that, I'll give my perspective at this point, it's fairly strong on DAC and on tax, so the capital you have to hold for those items can be very large. It doesn't take into account, for instance, liquidity, or may not take into account new business, and there are arguments that would say it's perhaps in some ways light on insurance risk. So it's a particular perspective on risk. It's not the only one. There's more that you need to be looking at. And lastly, my perspective, I'm with Cominsure. We're a direct insurer. We have a wide range of products. I think everything except variable annuities. We invest in, we certainly have to do every single one of the asset risk charge scenarios. So we're exposed to all the asset risks. And I say that I have no experience in reinsurance or friendly societies and, as I said, variable annuities. And one last comment is that our PAR business, we're an 80-20 company. So if I say 80% or 20%, I'm talking about our policyholder, shareholder split of profits on the PAR business. So I just automatically say 80-20. That's what I mean if I'm talking about 80-20. As we go through this, so terminology, the makeup of the capital requirement, the asset risk charge, insurance risk charge, you'll start to see just the abbreviations through the presentation. And I've just mentioned there where the standards deal with these items. Just to note that APRA have the capacity to add a supervisory adjustment to get the final prudential capital requirements to the number that you calculate. They also have the authority to adjust any of the four risk charges. So they can require an adjustment to the risk charges on top of the calculations specified in the standards. Now, if you were here just over last year for the life insurance reporting session, you would have seen this slide. So this, on the left side, the first three columns give a balance sheet view to get what your shareholder equity is. So you have all your assets, your policyholder and other liabilities giving you your net assets. And then on the right side, the three columns giving what would be the regulatory capital view. So not all those assets that you hold are suitable as capital, so there are adjustments related to things like DAC, tax, Tier 2 capital if you're holding it. The adjustments can be negative. They don't have to necessarily be a reduction. We'll get into those a bit more soon. The far right column shows you the build-up of the PCA, adding up the components that they've set out in the standards. And then, obviously, you'll have target capital and your excess assets, or not excess, depending, to get the final result. These calculations are performed independently of statutory fund level. So everything has to be done independently for each statutory fund. The only exception to that is tax. So there is an ability to offset tax liabilities from one fund to tax assets in another. But that's the only exception to doing these calculations entirely at a statutory fund level. And that obviously has curious consequences where you'll have one statutory fund, it's assuming interest rates are up, and another statutory fund, it's assuming interest rates are down. There isn't that capacity to offset as there were in the previous standards. So again, just a bit more background. This comes from the APRA database of it's on their website, their life insurance stats. And what I've done here is just added up all the non-linked funds for direct insurers to give us an idea of what is being held as capital. So you can see we're holding just under $5 billion in our PCA. For perspective, we're also holding $9 billion of adjustments. So, in fact, the adjustments are a bigger element, but you don't see that in the capital base versus PCA comparison. It looks like the direct insurers are mostly an asset risk entity with a bit of insurance risk, but in fact the insurance risk has the capacity to offset positive cash flow, so DAC recovery and profit. So So in fact, the insurance risk is much larger than that, and the insurance risk that's actually in the business would be significantly larger than the asset risk. So whilst when you look at the PCA numbers, the insurance risk looks smaller, it is actually a much bigger risk than the asset risk. That's just the nature of the calculation that's in the standards. Also worth noting that my particular interest, the combined stress scenario adjustment, the CSSA, it is a substantial amount. So that's about 15% for direct insurers of total PCA. So if you don't understand that number, you're not going to understand your capital position, and that is the black box of our regulatory capital. A further comment on that is that if you looked at the various insurers, which we'll see, it ranges from 0 up to 30% of the PCA. So there are some companies with a very substantial combined stress scenario adjustment. The linked business, not surprisingly, is basically an operational risk with a little bit of asset risk, but very simple. And finally, for completeness, the reinsurers are much more like what you would expect, very heavily weighted towards insurance risk. And again, you can see for the direct insurers, whilst there's an enormous amount of funds under management, there really isn't a lot of capital. It is just that 0.25% plus a bit of asset risk. So that's the industry total. That's by the 12 largest direct insurers and the 5 largest reinsurers. So I just chose any company that had more than 50 million in PCA. So this is their balance in the 14-15 year. First point to make is that there's a lot of different profiles there of what makes up the PCA. No great surprise that Challenger, which is basically an annuity business, is basically an asset risk. Having said that, they've been taking up some insurance deals, so they've been managing to throw in a bit of insurance risk, which is almost entirely offset by the aggregation benefit, no great surprise. So they can do those things with almost no capital cost, regulatory capital cost. No great surprise that AMP, with by far the largest participating book, is also, when you look at that, mainly asset risk. It gets a bit more curious when you, if you were to compare, so Colonial, CMA, and AIA. We look like we have a similar profile there of asset risk and insurance risk, but then our aggregation benefits are quite different, and so are our combined scenario adjustments. And we're certainly very different companies, but we've ended up with a similar profile. And even similarly, we have a similar mix to Zurich, but they've managed to do that with no combined scenario adjustment. So people's capital positions are very different, and there are a lot of other things that are driving that difference between these companies. Another similarity, though, you'll see is, for instance, the companies that are heavily involved in the group risk market. So you'll see Tower, AIA, MetLife have all got around their biggest in insurance risk. So there are some things you can see make sense. Other parts, harder to see. But most importantly, there's a vast range of profiles because it changes very much depending on your position. And again, whilst someone like Zurich at the moment doesn't have a combined stress scenario adjustment, if I was their capital management actuary, I'd still be desperate to understand it, because as soon as I get into stress testing, it becomes a problem for me. Okay, so having provided some background on these numbers, we'll start with the capital base. When it comes to net assets, the only thing I'd say is that if you're investing in other than common equity, then you've got to be aware of the limits that APRA gives you. So at least 60% of your PCA must be common equity tier 1, and at least 80% must be tier 1. So if you're going to, which most of us have, if you're going to start having not just common equity tier 1, then you need to be aware of these thresholds. You need to be monitoring your position against them. And even more so, you need to know what are the stresses that are going to cause me to breach these. So that's probably all I have to say about the net assets themselves. the adjustments that we have to make. So, again, I speak from my perspective. The biggest one, the CMLA, is the liability adjustment, the difference between the policy liability and the adjusted policy liability. So, the adjusted policy liability. For risk business, that's the greater of your risk-free BEL and your termination value. For your retail risk, that will almost always be your termination value. And even for your group risk, it would mostly be your termination value. I'd be surprised for it to be the risk-free BEL. And if those two products are in the same fund, even more surprised. So your policy liability for your adjusted policy liability for the risk business should nearly always be the termination value. For your participating business, we have what's called the participating policy liability. And it's the risk-free BEL, but then you would add on the value of policyholder bonus, which for us is roughly, 80% of the excess assets above the BEL. For par business as well, you have to adjust the termination value. So if your termination value wouldn't exhaust your policyholder retained profits, then you have to increase it. So that if the surrender value was paid out, the entire policyholder retained profits would be paid out at that time. So the policyholders are getting what they're entitled to. So it's, for par business, it's not the straight termination value. It may be, but it may need an adjustment to increase it for policyholder profits. What that means is, again, that the adjustment for risk business is largely around DAC. That's the big driver of this policy adjustment. For annuities and for par business, it's mostly around shareholder profit margins, although you've also got a difference potentially in your valuation basis. So the discount rate. The discount rate for capital is the CTS curve with an illiquidity premium for annuities. The Institute has an information note on deriving discount rates if you want to explore that more. But there is the potential, if you're using something else as your best estimate, your reporting discount rate, that you'll get an impact from different valuation bases. And finally, this number is calculated net of tax. Brings us on to tax. So the second biggest, certainly for us, is the deferred tax assets, which are admissible. So as a starting point, you've got your balance sheet DTLs or DTAs. You then need to add the tax effect of the liability adjustment. Now for us, that's a big number. So whilst we are DTLs on the balance sheet, we end up well and truly in DTAs when it comes to our capital position, so we end up with a large inadmissible asset. The point to make here is that if you do end up with an inadmissible asset, then your capital base has just become a lot more volatile. So two examples. One would be on your risk business. So if you sell policies, if you're on a net basis, it'll be the DAC net of tax that affects your capital base. But if your assets, if you're in a DTA position, you will now need to hold for the gross DAC impact. More dramatic example is if you've got par business. So if you have ordinary par business and you make $100 on equities, you'll pay 30% tax. So you've got a 70% increase in your net assets. On your APL, that will absorb 80% of that for us. So that means our liability will go up 56. So if we make 100 excess, 100 return on equities, we'll improve our net asset position by $14. But if our tax assets are inadmissible, we've also just picked up a $30 deferred tax liability. So if I'm having inadmissible tax assets, my net position changes by $44. So there's quite a big difference in what's happening to your capital base depending on whether you're in a deferred tax asset position or a liability position. And that volatility then flows through to the rest of the capital position as well. And there are also adjustments for intangibles, all sorts of other stuff. We run a very neat balance sheet, so I don't have to deal with any of those, so I'm not going to give you any insight into them. So the first component of the PCA is the asset risk charge. I actually, sorry to go back. non-participating investment account, because we don't have a big book of that, but normally non-participating investment account will often be on termination value, just going back to the capital base. And that's partly driven by the rules around having to keep termination value quite close to the asset share. So the asset risk charge, measuring your ALM risk. It's an instantaneous shock at the reporting date, and that's an important thing to remember when we get later on to the combined scenario adjustment. So this is a shock of the assets at the reporting date and of the liabilities at the reporting date. You're allowed to adjust for management actions. As always, they must be appropriate, justifiable, and equitable. So that may mean changing bonus rates, changing investment mix, changing discretionary charges, or even potentially, I wonder, on our IP business repricing as well, on the asset risk side. The asset risk charge is net of tax. And as an aside, remember that if you've got any non-risk business in there, there's a good chance that the gross of tax asset risk charge is not simply the net divided by the tax rate. So on your ordinary PAR business, the liability side is not taxed. It's only the asset side that's taxed. So you can end up with a very small asset risk charge, which has got a huge amount of tax sitting in there. So the gross, when you have to think of the position being gross, it's very different from the net position if you've got non-risk business in your asset risk charge. Just going through the shocks, the real interest rate shock is a multiple of the yield. So I've got a slight question mark, but generally that means that as interest rates fall, that shock will reduce. And we now have that interesting position of what will we do with negative interest rates? And what does that mean for this shock? So the Federal Reserve has just put out a stress test which has got negative interest rates in it. So how do you respond with an asset risk charge where... Anyway, that's a question for us to work out. The expected inflation shock is the 1.25 or 1% change to the yield. So as interest rates fall, the effect of that shock increases. The currency shock, I guess the only thing I'd point out there is that you add up the losses. So you don't get to offset. If you make a profit on one currency against a loss on the other, the charge is just the losses. There's not offsetting between currencies. You don't offset gains on one against losses on the other. The equity shock also includes a volatility shock to equity volatility. Point to note, on the equity and property shocks being an increase to the yield means that, at least in the short term, they're somewhat countercyclical. So if the market falls, the dividend yield increases, and so the impact of the shock will be a bit smaller. So there, in the short term, there's a countercyclical element to those equity and property shocks. From playing around with the asset risk charge, I think you could probably get diversification in excess of 40%. So the aggregate charge could probably get below 60% of the sum of all the different charges. I couldn't get it below 50, if you can. But that just looking at what you could do, you could certainly get a diversification factor of under 60% in your asset risk charge. And clearly, it gives incentive to manage your investment mix to minimise capital. Having said that, there are some trade-offs that we need to be very aware of if we're going to do that. The first is that if you manage to get your asset mix set up very nicely for capital, then you're probably going to find your profits very volatile, certainly if you have a significant DAC. Then you've just introduced volatility into your profit by getting it out of your capital. So if you've got a significant DAC, you'll have a significant trade-off between getting an asset mix that works for capital against one that works for profit reporting. The second one is, on PAR business, you're obviously seriously constrained by policyholder interests. So, yeah, I would just say that, you're very constrained. The insurance risk charge, the second component, quite an involved process. to get through to the insurance risk charge. Again, you're allowed to you allow for management actions, again most likely repricing or bonus rates. And there is a lot of there's a lot in the standards about what you can do for repricing. So you cannot reprice in the first 12 months. And then the period to your repricing should allow for your company's ability to understand the shocks and respond to them, which means working out what repricing you're going to do and then implementing the repricing. And that's obviously going to be very different on your retail book compared, say, on your group risk schemes that are coming up for tender. You cannot reprice for random shocks or event stresses. You cannot reprice for the stresses on your termination value. And in fact, paragraph 24 says that the present value of the increase in premium from the repricing must be less than the increase in the present value of the claims and expenses. Now, that works fairly well on the claim side. I haven't yet worked out what that means for lapses, so I don't understand how you can reprice for lapses under that constraint. In practice, we found that the easiest way for us to model this is to turn off the stresses. So we, within profit, when we're modelling our liabilities, we put a stress in, and then rather than trying to model an increase in premiums, we just turn the stress back off again at the point where we would consider we reprice. So that's, for us, being the simplest way. It gets more complicated for income protection business because you can only turn the stresses off on claims that you incur after repricing. So if you incur a claim on your IP, but then you're modelling it then for 30 years, you can't turn the stress off on that claim because you have no capacity to reprice for that person who's now on the claim. So you can't just turn stresses off either when it comes to termination rates. You can turn them off as long as it was a claim incurred after the repricing date, but leave it on if it wasn't. So, working through this, first step is to set the stress margins, and again, the Institute has issued an information note that gives some ideas around how to do that. You then have to calculate the impact of 6 margins on your RFL or your PPL. Therefore, your future mortality and future morbidity, your random mortality, your random morbidity, the event stress, and longevity. So you have those 6 calculations. From that, you then work out your insurance risk diversification factor. Okay, our experience is that thankfully this number's been steady. So this is one of the numbers that stays fairly stable for us. Retail business will tend to be most heavily exposed to event stress and morbidity, so retail lump sum. Retail IP obviously very heavily exposed to morbidity. The group business, again, highly exposed to event stress, probably more so than the retail. And again, depending on the nature of the morbidity benefits, is how exposed you are. So if you are in long-term IP, then you'll be very heavily exposed to morbidity. If you're in short-term IP, that'll be reduced quite a bit. So, having worked out your insurance risk diversification factor, you then apply that to your original stresses and get diversified stresses to now work out your insurance risk charge. That's relatively straightforward for everything but the IP. The IP termination stress has a non-linear impact, so you may well have to come up with some iterative process to determine what's the IP termination stress that satisfies the diversified factor. You'll need to choose your product groups for the lapse stress, because you have to decide if it's going to be a high lapse or a low lapse. So you will need to work out what product groups will go together and which ones don't. So having done that, you calculate the impact of those diversified stresses. determine whether it's on a high or a low lapse. And part of that is to perform this 12-month test, which is that your stress liability must be able to fund the stress-adjusted policy liability in 12 months' time. Now, by definition, the stress RFL will fund the stress RFL in 12 months' time. So what you're testing is funding the stress termination value in 12 months' time. Again, your stress termination value at time zero will fund the stress termination value on those same claims in 12 months' time. So this becomes your stress termination value at time zero plus the discounted value of 12 months of premiums, incurred claims and incurred expenses on the stress basis. So now we've introduced this looking forward to what will happen over the next 12 months. That's the way you calculate the insurance risk charge. Now, if for business that is taxed purely on profit, you can just calculate that number and then and discount it. But again, for all of your traditional investment account business, as far as I can see, you've got no choice but to build a complete revenue account through the 12 months to work out how much do you need to hold at the start in order to fund the termination value at the end. So it does become, for that business, a fairly complicated calculation. I should have said, yeah, I'm happy to take questions on the way through if you've got them. Otherwise, we'll just keep working through these elements. The aggregation benefit. Just back on the insurance risk charge. Ultimately, what you're holding for the insurance risk charge is the impact of the stresses less whatever positive cash flow you've got in that business. So this is on your risk business. So that positive cash flow to recoup DAC and profit margins over the 12-month period, that's there to offset your insurance risk, the stresses to get your insurance risk charge. That number can be negative, you can only put a zero down.
Can you please explain that again? So your stress liability should fund your stress liabilities in 12 months.
The requirement and standard is that the stress liability in this charge funds the stress adjusted policy liability in 12 months' time. So an adjusted policy liability is the greater of the RFL or the termination value. Your stress, if your stress RFL is higher than that, you've got to hold it anyway at time zero. So by definition, your stress RFL will look after funding the stress RFL in at time 12. So I didn't explain that. So at time zero, you may have to hold your stress RFL, or you may have to hold this stress termination value. If you end up on RFL, then it will fund the RFL in 12 months' time. So you've already tested to see if that's going to be higher effectively. So then what you're checking is the stress termination value now plus stress cash flows over 12 months going to give me a higher liability? Now, if there's a moderate amount of positive cash flows, whether it's DAC recovery or profit margin, and that's allowing for the fact that you're able to reprice down the track, then you'll nearly always end up on termination value. I speak from a direct insurer, so I wouldn't want people to think that applies to the reinsurers because I have no capacity to comment there. Does that answer the question? So the aggregation benefit, a simple calculation between insurance risk charge and the asset risk charge, a 20% correlation. If this number really comes down to the relativity between those two charges. If they're equal, you'll get your diversification factor of 77.5. That's as low as you'll get it. But even if either of those charges is 15%, the smaller one, if it's 15% of the larger, you'll get a factor of 90%. So you do get aggregation benefits quite quickly. So when one charge is relatively small, that aggregation factor can change quite a bit. Asset concentration risk charge has limits on concentration applying to both investment assets and your exposure to reinsurers. The limits depend on the quality of those exposures. And I quoted APRA in one of their response documents. The purpose here was to strongly discourage asset concentration. So this particular element, it's not aiming to be a risk-sensitive charge. It's aiming to strongly discourage. Again, the operational risk charge is another fairly simple formula. 3% of the greater of premium and adjusted policy liability for your risk business, 2% if you're an insurer. Oh, so I've got a reinsurer thing in there. By the way, I should say, just to cover off friendly societies, I showed you those capital numbers. I think the capital for friendly societies is about 100 million across the industry. That's my friendly society comment. That's all I can give you. The other thing is the operational risk charge is if there's significant changes, and there's a particular formula for calculating that, if the business is either increasing rapidly or decreasing rapidly, then there'll be additional risk charge on the excess above that 20% threshold. Which brings us to where all the action is, the combined stress scenario adjustment. This is set out in LPS 110 and in attachment B. It's fairly prescriptive. There are a lot of musts, as it should be, in a standard. It describes its purpose as to address exhausting margins on the participating business and to address inadmissible tax assets. When we're working through the logic process, you could understand that when you shock your assets through 7 different shocks and then add them together with a correlation factor and then add them to an insurance risk charge with another correlation factor, that you're finding it hard to work out just what exactly is the tax position. So a single scenario was then prescribed in order to do that. Also, when you're a PAR business, I mean, to take an extreme example, you may have just enough margins in your business to survive, to absorb those shocks, so that the policyholder margins go to zero under each of the shocks. But then when you combine it, you're going to have something that's like 4 or 5 times the charge, 4 or 5 times larger than any of those single charges. And so the PAR business is no longer able to survive it. But the asset risk charge has assumed it did. So clearly, under that scenario, the margins would have been well and truly exhausted, and the liability needs to be quite a bit higher. So the standard mentions these two factors as the reason behind the combined stress scenario adjustment. So the steps in doing this involve calculating further diversified stresses. So your insurance stresses that you've already diversified, you now multiply also by a diversification factor from the aggregation benefit. Your lapse, expense, and other stresses in your insurance risk you also reduce by that diversification factor. And your asset stresses have a similar process of allowing for diversification. So that's the way you come up with the stresses for this scenario. You also need to work out from the insurance risk charge, was I on a high lapse or a low lapse? So you know which lapse stress to apply. And you need to know what am I doing to my interest rates in the asset scenario. And my expected interest and my expected inflation and my real interest. Are they up or are they down? So that I apply that scenario I apply the right stress in this scenario. On top of that, there is a requirement to calculate this adjustment if the statutory fund has participating business, using interest rates down and inflation down. The liability is calculated as it is for the insurance risk charge. So again, if you've got traditional or investment account business, you'll need to perform calculate a full revenue account in order to work out what is the liability I need to fund the 12-month test, to work out am I on the RFL or am I on the 12-month test. So we're starting to get there. Next is tax. So the DTAs in this calculation are inadmissible, and the standard says you must include all additional tax assets and liabilities accruing over the 12 months following the reporting date. So having built a revenue account to work out what your liability is, you've now worked it out on your traditional and participating investment account business. So now you build another one to work out the tax position. This is needed because you, if you're on the RFL, you haven't done this calculation. So if you end up on the RFL, you need to work out what's my RFL in 12 months' time to get a closing liability to then work out what's going to be the revenue account and the consequent tax position, so that you can come up with a final deferred tax position, which you may then have to treat as inadmissible. That enables you to calculate a capital base under this scenario, from which you deduct the insurance risk charge, asset risk charge, and aggregation benefit to get the adjustment itself. So you can see, you need to understand tax if you want to understand capital. You have to have a very good understanding of tax if you want to understand capital, because it has an enormous impact. The combined scenario then has a number of other effects. So if your insurance risk charge was zero, that would mean that your positive cash flows were greater than the stresses that you're applying under the insurance risk. So that means you've got a little bit there that's available to offset things like the deferred tax assets. Your IP profitability. Now, at this point, remember, the asset risk charge is done at a point in time, but we're now valuing over 12 months. Now, I realised last night, ignore the inflation down, but if on your asset risk charge you've ended up with interest rates, the real interest rates up, then those 12 months of cash flows for your IP business, they'll be a bit more profitable. So that will just reduce your combined stress scenario adjustment a little bit. Conversely, if it's down, you'll be a bit worse off capital-wise. So ignore the inflation down. I don't think the inflation down has an impact because your claims will be going up with inflation, you'll be discounting back with the adjusted curve. Another minor adjustment is that your IP termination stress is not linear, it's a cumulative one, but in the combined stress scenario, you just multiply the stress by the diversification factor, and you do not need, in this instance, to allow for it being non-linear. The actual IP termination stress itself, I shouldn't have copied this up to the previous one. If interest rates are up and inflation is down, then that stress will be applying to a slightly smaller set of claims, and you'll be discounting it at a bigger number. So the impact of that stress will be reduced if your asset scenario is interest up, inflation down. If you've got a fair bit of PAR business, this is quite a substantial possibility. Your DTAs and your DTLs will depend on the asset shock. So if your shocks are down, then on your fixed interest business, you've made money and you've generated DTLs in this scenario, so that will then flow through into your final position. And conversely, if you're on an up-up, well then you're generating DTAs, and that will take away from your capital position. So if you've been finally balancing between a down and an up, and you suddenly flick, switch between one of those, then you'll potentially get quite a jump in your capital because you've suddenly changed your DTA position. And you are talking about, you know, potentially a 2 or 3% interest rate change here, so it can be quite a substantial effect. Which brings me... Oh, sorry, we'll go through a few others first before I get on to... the PAR business, there'll be second-order effects around yields and lapses. So if you're using very low yields, if you're shocking interest rates down, then lower lapses mean the business hangs around even longer and those guarantees are costing you more. And obviously the converse. I mean, and it's around this that the down requirement, I assume, was put in. My understanding on non-participating investment account would be it could be rather sensitive to up, because it's non-participating. If it's on termination value, it's fairly interest insensitive. And if you have an up-up, you're going to be losing money and also generating DTAs. So non-participating investment account, I think, is probably least happy in an up-up scenario. I would expect PAR business generally is least happy, certainly traditional, and if you've got lots of growth assets in a down-down, and from what you see there with IP, whether it's group or retail, it's the happiest in an up-down. So then your fund will depend on what mix of business you've got across all of these. Another second order effect would be that because you've got to include all the tax effects over the 12-month period, you'll also have the tax effects coming out of that revenue account for the next 12 months. So that will also affect your combined stress scenario adjustment. Which means that you really do want to monitor all the thresholds that you have in these calculations and the trends. So that means, do I have an insurance risk charge? How close am I to going to zero or becoming positive? One of our funds started through 2013 and 2014 did not have an insurance risk charge. And then we increased benefits on one of our products, and that generated an insurance risk charge, which meant we got a diversification factor, which you can apply to the entire insurance risk charges, which are offset by the positive cash flow, so our capital reduced. That's what happens. I would argue that it moved closer to what it was meant to be, so I had no problem with that. But you can do things which increase your risk and reduce your capital if you're in a certain position. I say that in the sense, I don't mean aim to do things, but we did something. We improved the benefits, it increased our risk, it reduced our capital. The aggregation benefit. So again, if either your insurance risk charge or asset risk charge are relatively small compared to the other, then it has the potential to move around quite a bit. So you want to just see how sensitive are you to the aggregation benefit. Importantly, the asset risk scenario. Flipping between scenarios, so if you're sitting close between different scenarios and you move, then as you can see, your deferred tax position could change quite a bit and your capital could change quite dramatically. On top of that, you have those other second order effects on things like IP and investment account, which means that you won't just get a nice smooth change. Another one to be wary of is, again, with PAR business. So if your PAR business is able to survive the combined scenario adjustment and still have some profit margins, then broadly you're absorbing 80% of those shocks. But as soon as you run out, then it's going to be hitting the shareholder for 100%. So the trend is going to be very different. So you want to be aware, am I getting close to that happening? And if it does, how fast is capital going to change afterwards? So I guess it brings sort of an alternative view. I was explaining our capital position to a previous appointed actuary, and he said, so it's just customised Cap A. So there's an element, if you have a combined stress scenario adjustment, that everything that we've talked about prior to the combined stress scenario adjustment is a way of coming up with stresses for a scenario that are customised to your company, customised to your product mix, customised to your asset mix, customised to the way your statutory funds are set up, customised to all these things. So you've ended up doing a lot of work to come up with your stresses to do one scenario. And then, I guess this is now the way I tend to look at our capital position. So what I'm showing on the chart is the PCA plus deductions, so it's the amount of capital I'm holding above or below my policy liability. And for this retail lump sum, I'm showing you gross of tax because that becomes the easiest. Ultimately, tax becomes pretty much 30% of the final number. So you can see straight away tax, in that example, is the second biggest risk that we're holding capital for. The biggest one, obviously, is the DAC. And then we hold the DAC, but then we get the benefit of our positive cash flows. And then we have the future stresses that we're applying to claims after valuation date, the stresses on termination value, asset risk charge, operational risk charge. So that's a lump sum product. If you were to look at retail IP, it would be similar, but the DAC's probably going to be a bit smaller, and the stresses are going to be a bit bigger, relatively speaking. So the insurance stresses are going to be bigger, and even the asset stress is likely to be bigger. Group risk will be similar, but with almost no DAC, and maybe not much best estimate, positive cash flows. So I find this helpful in the end, because now I can monitor what's going on. So on each of those things, I can look what's causing the changes. So on DAC, I can look at sales, I can look at lapses, I can look at my best estimate assumptions, I can look at yields. Those are what is going to drive the DAC. Best estimate cash flows are going to be driven by my volumes and by my best estimate assumptions. The future stresses, again, volumes, best estimate assumptions, stress margins, a little bit of yields, and then the diversification. What diversification have I got in this fund, and how is it impacting on these stresses? Same apply to the CTV stresses. The asset risk, that will obviously all sorts of things. That really is your ALM position and the diversification that you have against insurance risk. Operational risk, nice and simple, so that's driven by your volumes. So that's a sort of a retail a risk product. On the PAR business, it's a bit more like this. So I effectively have present value of shareholder margins as a deduction. So that's available to fund the stresses. Small amounts of insurance stress and lots of asset risk. And then operational risk. Now this one I kept tax separate. So tax is then a separate item leading up to a PCA plus deductions. So this is very helpful in monitoring your PAR business, because what you want to know is how big is that purple and what's it going to take it? What's it going to take to lose the purple? What sort of stresses would cause that to disappear so that then your capital position becomes quite volatile? So that's where I end up with in my regulatory capital. I have one more slide. Was just to show the liability calculations that we've done to get to this position. So I've said 23, but in fact the way we do our IP business is we need an iterative process at the start to set our random morbidity and our future morbidity, so there are a couple of extra. So for us to do a full run through, we're looking at in excess of 25 liability calculations. We can go all the way down the first column and start our way down the second until we get to the insurance risk diversification factor. We've got to stop, aggregate everything, do the calculations for that factor. We then need an iterative process to work out what the stress is on the IP business. We can then do the diversified insurance risk runs, having had that. Stop again, calculate our aggregation benefits, work out our new set of stresses, and then we can finally run our combined scenario runs. Now, as much as the standard requires you to run down. As you can see, if you're not running all four, you're not understanding your risks as well as you could. So you really do need to run all four to understand what you're actually exposed to. Because depending on your products, down may not be your problem. It could easily be a different asset scenario. So you really need to run all four to have any idea. On top of that, once you get into stress testing and scenario testing, and you're trying to do these calculations, when interest rates are near zero and the market's fallen 40%, then you never know where you end up. So you need to do all of them to work out what the answer is. Dave.
Sorry, David laughed. So can you elaborate a little bit more on where we should be keeping an eye on the tax in that process?
Well, the crucial thing is, are you in a DTA or a DTL position, firstly in the capital base, and then also in the combined scenario? So if you're in the capital base, then already your capital base will be volatile. So that comes down to both your balance sheet position and then the effect of the liability adjustments. The combined scenario, obviously, is a much more complicated thing because you've now done all of these stresses, had a 12-month revenue account, and you've got a tax position at the end. So you're just looking at where is my position? Am I in a DTA or DTL? We're so firmly DTA, we don't have to worry about looking at it too much. But also, you're able to offset DTLs from other funds. So if you do still have DTLs in other funds, then that's available as an offset. So you also want to be looking, for instance, in your linked funds, once you get to the end of this combined scenario, what position are they in? And are they able to actually fund some of these DTAs through their DTLs? So you need to be looking at what position your linked funds are in as well. Or in fact, you need to be looking at all of your funds and then working out what's my tax position across the entire company.
If you go back to the slide where you had the chart of all the companies' PCAs,
yep.
I noticed the reinsurers look very different. They've got this combined stress scenario that is a lot higher than the rest.
Yes.
Can you explain why that would be?
No. No.
Okay.
Sorry.
Any reinsurer in the room that can explain?
That's the idea.
Yeah, it's just interesting to me.
Yep. Swipe the mic.
I'd be keen to hear any thoughts around the treatment of the DAC in terms of it's such a large adjustment you have to hold on the balance sheet, so it can significantly reduce any return on equity or capital calculations, and particularly when a in-force book is in its earliest stages and the entire acquisition expenses are held. And then also around IFRS 4 and the potential changes there that that might impose.
Right. We run it nice and vanilla. So we have a DAC and we hold it. So clearly companies have been doing something about that. So there's been things happening with reinsurance to address that. But aside from that, I really, you've moved beyond my ability to explain. And certainly for IFRS 4, I'm out of my league room. Yeah, sorry about that. So I've reached the end of the presentation, so questions, now's the time for questions. So two questions here. The first was just the terminology I've been using of linked and non-linked. So the linked business is what we would call our unit-linked business, so the policy liabilities are directly linked to the value of the assets. So that business has no implicit asset risk. The policyholders are bearing the entire asset risk and the shareholders don't need to except on their shareholder funds. So non-linked is then everything else. So non-linked would be annuity book, risk business, traditional business, investment account business is what I'm referring to as the non-linked. And clearly that we're required to have separate statutory funds for our linked business against our non-linked. So then the capital of those is kept quite separate, apart from the tax element. Another question, what is CET1 versus AT1? So CET1 is the common equity T1 capital, so that's your standard ordinary shares. Additional T1 capital, so that's preference shares. So if you go into which LPS defines what you can include as additional T1, it's either 110 or 112, we'll go through all the criteria for what enables something to be treated as additional T1 capital. And then on top of that, there's additional Tier 2 capital. Again, the standards address what is required for something to be included as that, so some form of subordinated debt or the like.
Ross, I'm Martin Lan from Deloitte. I just want to ask, if you were APRA, what sort of changes would you make to the current standards to, you know, improve it even more?
I don't envy them that task, I have to say. There are things that I don't like about the standards. When I look at it, I go, I wouldn't have come up with any better. So, what are the things that I have trouble working out what to do are around the lapse stress. So mine are fairly technical. The repricing as it relates to lapse stress, it's just moderately minor. What I find much harder is group risk. So how does the group risk business work within the standards? For me, I think it's you can work out principles and try and do it properly, but if you've got a scheme that's coming up for tender in 7 months and your board hasn't agreed yet to a price, what are you going to do about that? Because the standards say you can't allow for repricing. So for me, and on top of that, obviously, a lapse stress where you're saying, okay, I've got 50,000 policies, I can work out a relatively reliable lapse rate. If I've got one big scheme, what's the lapse stress on that business? And what are you going to do? So for me at the moment, I think you can work out the principles and apply sensible capital amounts to group risk business. That's fine. I would like standards to be a bit clearer in how to do that. And that's all around what happens after tender date of schemes, most particularly, you know, given our 12-month test, it's anything that happens in the next 12 months. So once a scheme slips inside that 12-month period, what are you going to do about schemes that are tendering? Because one extreme option under these standards is that no one holds capital for them. The incumbent says, well, I'll keep it, but the premium goes up so much that they won't return to me, and there's no one else is going to volunteer to hold the capital for them. So that's one extreme possibility, is that any scheme that's inside the 12 months that's still up for tender, no one holds capital for it. Actually, another point just while talking about the 12-month test, repricing is something you should monitor all the way through this. So the standards don't say you can just get to the end and wonder if your repricing is okay. The standards, to me, are clear that you need to be happy that your repricing is appropriate, justifiable and equitable in each circumstance. So that's a fairly onerous requirement. Having said that, it's not too hard in your spreadsheets to set them up so it tells you what repricing you assume. Having said that, the 12-month test now says that, the implication of the 12-month test is as long as you can reprice so the 12-month test applies, that's the important thing, because then you won't be repricing inside the 12 months. So that doesn't actually affect your capital position. The particular level of repricing that you do. It's the ability to reprice so that it's the termination value that applies, not the RFL. That's the crucial element of your repricing. Another point I was going to say at the start and I forgot was, so at Cominshaw, we've learnt about events that are inside 99.5 recently. We didn't know about them not that long ago. I say that in that you need to approach this with humility. So I have not the faintest idea what 99.5 is. My job is to calculate it, so I do my best. But be willing to listen to arguments. Be willing to look at other things. Don't hold too strongly to the fact that you've got 99.5 worked out. Because we don't.
Stuart Roger from Deloitte. You talked about thresholds and be careful as you approach the thresholds. And I'm not a life insurance practitioner. I got the impression that as a threshold early on in the process causes you to change to a different scenario, it's got ramifications all the way down the chain afterwards. So a couple of things come from that if I've understood it properly. Firstly, in practice, do companies come close to thresholds frequently, or is it a fairly rare event? And then following on from that, if you see you're coming close to one of those thresholds, how much is it under your own control to stay away from it versus how much is it just done to you by what happened out there in policyholder interface land? And so those are the two questions about how do you deal with the thresholds. And then I think there's a third question in there that kind of echoes Martin's one, that if I've understood it right and the threshold do have ramifications all the way down the process chain, then has it been structured wrongly? Should you be thinking those through as you do those early threshold calculations? So,
yeah. I think at a point in time, you're stuck with where you are. Some of those thresholds are under your control, so certainly on the asset side, you've got enormous capacity to play around with your investment mix to get where you want to be. Much harder on the insurance risk and even on the aggregation benefit. Tax side, that'll often be driven by what markets are doing. So again, your DTLs will do things that you may not want them. DTAs do things didn't appreciate. So the more you're on the asset side, the more you've got capacity to influence how close you are to those thresholds. But on the other ones, you get less and less so. Having said that, it has enormous implications to target surplus. So if you've just set your target surplus and you're just on one side of the threshold and you jump to the other and your capital falls 20 million, well, I would have thought your target surplus has gone up 20. So your total capital may not, you know, when you get to your final capital position, the thresholds may not be such an important factor.
Because you've taken account that it might change.
Yeah, so if I'm sitting just under a threshold, but going over is bad for me, then my target surplus would have to be holding something for that. So once I go past it, and then if I redo my target surplus, ideally it's going to come down most of that impact. So it doesn't, again, you know, you go back to the old capital world, and we're all happy redoing our target surplus. We were certainly happy redoing our target surplus once a year. That just doesn't work. That just doesn't work when you've got these sorts of thresholds and movements happening. So your capital position changes a lot depending on where you are at that point. So your target surplus is going to have to cope with that.
Particularly for power business, how does the model allow for value of options and guarantees, which could be quite asymmetric when you're applying stresses?
Absolutely. Excellent question. The adjusted policy liability needs to include allowance for asymmetric liabilities. So when you're calculating your participating your PPL, that needs to include allowance for the asymmetric nature. So if that's not enough under, you know, say, whatever approach you've got, then you need to increase it. Now that's going to apply to, if you've got profit share arrangements, then you'll have an asymmetric nature to them. Non-proportional reinsurance, you'll have an asymmetric nature to them. So those calculations now become much more complicated. So for instance, if you've got a profit share, you can't just assume the stress is a bit less than profit share, therefore I'll have nothing. You've got to allow, but the standard says you must be no less than the mean of the distributions. So now you've got to work out what's the distribution of the possible outcomes so that I can make sure I'm holding at least that amount. So it's a very good question that, you need to be including asymmetric liabilities.
Hi, I was wondering, presumably the calculation is all net of reinsurance. And for some of the contracts, if you're evaluating future cash flows, you know, reinsurer have the right to rewrite some of the treaties where your ability to rewrite the direct policies may be limited. From that perspective, do you reflect that in the capital calculation? Maybe part of the asymmetric nature of future liabilities?
Would be? Yes. We don't adjust. We just assume it all, because all our insurance is proportional, so we just keep it proportional. But yeah, so the only gross part of the calculation, I think, is for your default risk on the insurers. I think that's right. So
On Farisa from Munich Re. Just wanted to know if you've got some idea of industry practice, how to group different products for lapse, like it's going up or down, would be more favorable or more capital intense. So I find standards are quite silent on how to group different products. Is it like on a related product group that we report to APRA? Or?
I think it's more principle based, so it's products that you would expect to move together. So, as a general rule, group risk business, you'll always be worse off with more volume. So by the time they're stressed, I don't think anyone's got a group business that's profitable enough that they're not making a loss under a stressed position. So you're worse off having more group business. And in fact, at that point, it's not a lapse stress, it's a volume stress. So your stress on group risk business is actually that your member volumes balloon. It's not that you don't lose a business, but you've got a bit more chance of keeping it. It's actually that you keep it and the volumes jump up. On risk business, as long as there's a moderate amount of DAC or decent amount of profitability, then the risk business is nearly always going to be on a high lapse, because that just means you get less of the positive cash flows. But on IP, you may be on low. So it might depend on your mix of IP and lump sum. Par business depends on the yields. So at the moment, a low reduction lapses, the business staying longer is what's worse, because we're in a low interest rate environment and you've got a fund guarantees for longer. So par business at the moment is low, but if interest rates get back up 6 or 7, then it could be on that. So you can imagine once interest rates are high enough, then the interest rate more than funds the guarantee. So par business could drop to a change to a high lapse stress because it stops the profitable cash flows coming in, the good returns coming in. So par business depends on yields. But then you then have to decide which products are going to move together. So it may make sense, okay, I can put all my ordinary trad business together. It'll probably move together. But then when you get the group business, well, the good thing is it's probably just going to be an increase, so it doesn't matter. But you may need to look at individual schemes on your group business and say, what's going to happen to an individual scheme? So my understanding is that when it comes to actually choosing which groups, so we can work out what's likely to be the stress, is it up or down for particular products, but I have to choose which groups I'm going to put together and just test that group for up or down and test the next group for up or down. So to me, that's a decision that the standard leaves as a principle-based decision.
Just while everyone has a minute to come up with one last question, we've still got about 10 minutes before we need to finish up. I'm going to ask one question, which is capital allocation. So under the old standards, which was as a build from the bottom, capital allocation was relatively simple. We've now got sort of almost a top-down calculation where capital allocation is not obvious. Have you sort of thought about that, and have you got suggestions on how to do it?
So,
going? Okay, so clearly, if we looked at the capital that we're holding, say, on a risk business, then the biggest item is DAC, and the second biggest item is tax. So, you know, when you come to actually pricing for this business, do you really think that's the biggest risks that you need to be charging people for? And on top of that, when you go to your group business, well, the nature of the standard, because it's a 12-month test, says that you've only got to hold capital for 12 months of insurance stresses. But if you've just signed today for a scheme guaranteeing a rate on the 1st of January next year for 3 years, well, you're up for 3.5 years' worth of deterioration. That can all happen, and that's the risk you've just signed on for. So allocating 12 months' worth of capital on that business when you go to price it doesn't make any sense at all. That's a good way to go and get it wrong. I don't work in pricing, so I can provide some advice. But so we have within regulatory capital some items which you go, I don't really want to have to charge the policyholder for this because I don't think it's a big risk. Nevertheless, I've got to hold it. But I've also got some other bits where I want to charge the policyholder a whole lot more than that because I'm not holding enough. So you do need, you clearly have, just on that basis, on top of that, obviously, you've got all the diversification benefits. So how am I going to share diversification benefits? There's no obvious answer. I mean, clearly you want to understand what are all the real risks, and you want to be charging for all those real risks. And I guess
knowing, from my perspective, the DAC is a high number, the tax is a high number, so and I don't feel the need to charge the policyholder, so I'm happy to allocate, say, some of that away to the group business so that the group business is getting charged for the risks that they're taking on. But yeah, the allocation is, I don't have any magic answers. What I know, yeah, I guess it just comes back, what are the real risks? What do I want to make sure the policyholders are paying for? But then you're going to be left with the residual, and you do have to work out people are going to pay for it. No straight answers on that one.
Actually, I was going to say that the asset risk charge does not deal with the asset liability matching risk that well. So, for example, if you have a property portfolio that has a rental income that even match liability cash flows, you can still be sitting on a big asset risk charge through the credit risk component, yes. Sorry, that was a statement, but do you have any observation on that as well, I suppose?
Again, yeah, there's obviously the uncertainty around those rental yields, but yes, it's, so I would have thought you would want at least the asset risk around the uncertainty of receiving those yields, but yep.
Do I have a question now? Like, how do you see this interact or compare with the economic capital perspective? And we all know this is the regulatory capital, the calculation is probably based on some sort of industry average, but in reality, does any company actually take consider of their own risk characteristic, have their own view under the economic scenarios of what capital do you need to hold?
If there are people who want to comment on that, because I am very focused on regulatory capital and target surplus. I'd certainly say still that the regulatory capital calculation gives you an opportunity to understand your risks a hell of a lot better. To give an example, if CMLA wasn't to hold random risks, if we just set those margins to zero, our capital would fall by $3 million out of $1.5 billion. So when I first saw that, I thought, oh, that makes sense. That's why Solvency II, they didn't bother. But having said that, we do a bit more work on our random margins, and we've got a much better feel now for what is just the random volatility in our insurance result. And so, if we lose a couple of million this month and we don't have a reason, how hard should we go looking? So it's actually important to understand just what's the random volatility. Even though it's immaterial when it comes to capital, it's important to understand the risk. So then when I'm looking at my results, I've got a better understanding of what's going on. Or maybe just showing a bit of humility and not thinking I know what the answer is when it could have just been random.
It comes down to how you define economic capital. For most companies in Australia, they calculate regulatory capital, obviously, because they have to. And the regulatory capital basis is relatively conservative. So it targets the 99.5, but there are layers of conservatism in there. Companies need to make sure that they don't breach regulatory capital. So most companies hold target surplus, roughly calculated on a basis of some probability of sufficiency of meeting regulatory capital over a time frame. When you look at the total amount of assets you hold on that basis, that implies a very, very, very strong economic capital balance sheet. Where you do, if you consider a pure economic balance sheet, which is can I meet my policyholder liabilities over a time horizon. So some companies do calculate it. Most companies find that a conservative economic capital number is lower than what they actually hold on a regulatory capital plus target surplus basis.
So Anton, just picking up what you said there about companies will set their target surplus for a certain probability of not breaching regulatory requirements. What kind of range of probabilities is that for a typical company and over what time period?
Companies usually look at a 1 year time horizon and a high, so 95, 99, that sort of range.
So it's kind of like a 1 in 200 chance of breaching regulatory.
When you say
95... Oh, no, 1 in 20. 95% would be 1 in 20.
1 in 100, that's the range.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind, regulatory capital is quite conservative.
But it's the stay out of the regulator's hands probability that I'm interested in there. Because
And then the other sort of variable is to what extent do you allow for management discretion?
Yeah, that's quite a important decision for a board to make, because 1 in 50 might feel safe, right? It'll be 1 in every 7 or 8 chairmen face the problem, right? But equally, you could hold capital to keep you out of a 1 in 20 year situation, because part of your skills you bring to bear is that if you do breach the regulatory requirements, you negotiate with APRA, you have a reasonable reason why it happened. Every 2 decades is pretty rare anyway, and you work your way out of it. So in terms of a board adopting a risk appetite, I see that as a quite material decision by them as to safety versus sensible and wear some egg on the face sometimes.
It also comes down to what discretions are available. So you don't have to pre-fund if there are things you can do in an adverse scenario to raise capital of one form or another. And you don't need to hold it on day one. You just have to be willing to take those actions should the situation arise. Probably got time for one more question, or we can wrap up early if everyone's asked everything they want to ask. Anything else from the webinar? Okay, we'll call it to an end there. If everyone would just like to thank Ross for his presentation. I think if any of you didn't appreciate how complex the capital standards were, I'm sure you will do now. Obviously, all of us working in capital for life insurers, there is a challenge to make it understandable to other parts of the business and other stakeholders. So hopefully this was a step in that direction. Thanks everyone for coming, everyone on the webinar as well. This has been recorded, so if you know anyone who wanted to come but hasn't, there will be a recording available shortly. Thank you.